It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Thanksgiving is behind us, but we still have food on the brain here at Central Time. How about food in space? We'll hear how food for astronauts has developed over the last few decades.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Early this week, a federal court struck down a Wisconsin abortion law. We'll get the story behind that and look at what might happen next. We'll also take a look at the numbers from Wisconsin's deer hunt so far and discuss the state's prison guard shortage.
We're joined now by Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Robert, welcome back.
Thanks. Hello.
Well, first up, the Seventh Circuit Court in Chicago struck down a Wisconsin abortion law requiring providers to have admitting privileges. Can you recap that admitting privileges law for us?
Sure. So Wisconsin is one of 14 states that have passed these laws requiring admitting privileges, and in Wisconsin's case, it would have required doctors to be able to admit patients to hospitals within 30 miles of the clinic. This is a law that advocates have said is a way of protecting women's health. The stated rationale is that in the event of complications from an abortion, it'll make it easier to get the woman into a hospital. But, of course, the advocates of the law, which is, you know, Governor Scott Walker and when Wisconsin Republicans who passed it in 2013, also are staunch opponents of abortion. And so critics say that it's not really about women's health, but actually is about limiting abortions. And that is what the Seventh Circuit Court ruled this week.
Right. Tell us a little bit more about what the court said when they struck that down.
So the main thing is this ruling, which is written by a well-known judge named Richard Posner, really looked at the actual health data and found, I mean, it was written in pretty strong terms that it is not, in fact, the rates of complication are very, very low. When there are complications from abortions, they're typically not serious. And so it was a 2-1 decision, but writing for the majority, he really sort of laid into the law, what makes no sense is to abridge the constitutional right to an abortion on the basis of a spurious contention regarding women's health. Other such language, saying that basically this was that the women's health argument is sort of trumped up in this case.
Now, the state has appealed a ruling on this law before already. Do you think they'll appeal this one to the Supreme Court?
So this will be interesting to see. I mean, certainly the state will. This is, you know, the state's attorney general is behind this law. But at the same time, the Supreme Court already this month has agreed to take up essentially the exact same issue as one of the issues that they're taking up in a Texas law that also involved admitting privileges. So the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be hearing this case in the next session anyway, and I wouldn't be surprised if they end up sort of rolling this case in, or at the least what the ruling is the Supreme Court makes is likely to bind Wisconsin too.
And in terms of where this goes next, you think the state's just going to sit tight and wait for that Texas ruling, or it will get rolled in? I think the decision isn't until something like June.
Yeah, I mean, it's a technical matter, and the Supreme Court can sort of do what they want, you know what I mean? They can choose whether to hear them together, but they're so similar. And again, the issue is that, you know, since Roe versus Wade, there is a constitutional right to an abortion, and so this is exactly the case that is at issue, is whether these laws are sort of a backdoor way of limiting access to abortion. And that's the Supreme Court has ruled on this sort of case in the past, but of course we have a different Supreme Court today, so it's going to be a closely watched case for sure. And whether or not this explicitly is part of that Supreme Court, it will affect Wisconsin.
We're talking to Robert Menser from the Wausau Daily Herald right now for a Wisconsin News Roundup, and we're going to switch gears now and check out the state's gun deer hunting season. It's going to wrap up this weekend, and initially reports that license sales were a bit down. Where are we now?
Yeah, so this is we're coming into the end of gun deer season, and so everybody's trying to get some numbers on how things are going. Some of the preliminary DNR numbers showed about 158,000 deer harvested in the first 5 days of the season, which is higher than the same time last year. And so there's some projections could be on pace to beat that number. The last year's number of hunting licenses sold It was a little shy of 610,000, which was the fewest hunting licenses Wisconsin had sold since 1976. The high watermark of that was about 700,000 in 1990. So it's been a long decline in hunting participation, but it looks like the state may, there's a lot of like last minute sales, people that are buy when they go out today or tomorrow or the next day. But the projections right now show that they expect to exceed overall licenses sold and deer harvested, so there could be a little bit of an uptick.
Right, that's interesting, because it hasn't been a snowy beginning or any part of the season hasn't been particularly snowy, which can have an impact. And what are we looking at as far as numbers of the actual deer harvested?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, the last year's total was 222,588 that we had in the first 5 days, 158,000. So the thing I don't know is whether, is it usually that I would assume the opening weekend is heavier. So I don't know if that number sort of falls off as the season goes on. But they also said that the opening weekend numbers were up from last year.
Any indication that
it turned out to be cold? It got cold, at least. There's not a lot of snow, but I mean, it's a game, so supposedly that makes them move around more, you know.
Oh, interesting. Well, we talked earlier this week about chronic wasting disease and how that could have an impact. Have you had any indication that chronic wasting disease might be playing a role in whatever these numbers may be?
There, you know, it's always a concern, and it feels like a lot of the policies that have been in place have not worked, or at least it continues to be a big issue as chronic wasting disease sort of marches through more counties in the state. Another factor is there are 12 counties in the northern part of the state that are buck only this year for hunters, as the DNR is trying to rebuild herds that are have been affected by cold winters and wolves and such things. So there's a prohibition on taking antlerless deers there, which also would tend to depress the overall tally. But, you know, I guess we'll see when the final numbers come in.
Well, so finally, a Gannett investigation came out this week that looked into the state's prison guard shortage and the price tag on that shortage. Where are we with those numbers, Robert?
Yeah, so this was an interesting bit of reporting from Gannett, Wisconsin's I-team, and what our reporter in our Madison Bureau found was corrections workers have worked nearly 1.3 million hours of overtime between July 2014 and June 2015. That was up by 85,000 from the previous fiscal year, and it's way up if you look back to 2010, and it's cost taxpayers about $36 million in overtime pay. And more than that, I mean, it is a reflection on low staffing levels within Wisconsin's prisons that there's required this much overtime. And that is something that a lot of people, lawmakers and others, I mean, people within the system, say is a real safety concern.
And do Wisconsin officials have a handle on what could be causing the shortage?
So, you know, there are a lot of factors. There are understaffing levels and there are open positions, and lawmakers have talked about looking at, should they be paying more? Are there benefits issues? What is a way to get people and keep people in the job? Another interesting factor that our reporter uncovered is, that the increasing age of the prison population causes a need for more medical care, and as you sort of runs to hospitals and such, takes a big chunk of this overtime. I found this fascinating. The number of inmates in Wisconsin over the age of 50 has doubled in the past decade to about 4,000, and now that is about one in four prisoners in Wisconsin are over 50.
And just taking a look at possible solutions, I know there are different ideas on the table, but what are lawmakers and others saying about what's needed to correct this?
So it's a serious problem, and there was an audit that a legislative audit committee had sort of proposed, and then it was put to the back burner. I think that there are some who are calling to sort of move that up on the priority list. The issue is getting a lot of those positions filled. I think it's as simple as that. That needs to be a state priority. The other thing that may be of interest is it's actually in a way even worse than it looks. It's even more dramatic when you look at hours logged versus the percentage increase in cost. The state has done some technical changes in the way that overtime hours are logged, and when you look at the actual hours since 2010, it's an increase by 45%. So I mean, it's they're understaffed. Period. One last interesting thing is that a lot of the increases came from specifically from maximum security prisons, and at medium security prison, the cost actually went down by about $700,000.
Complicated story that everyone's going to be watching, sounds like. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Robert Mensah from the Wausau Daily Herald helping us recap the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
And food is on everyone's minds as we snack on Thanksgiving leftovers. It got us thinking about food in space.
Luckily for us, Discover Magazine just included a feature about the food astronauts eat and how that food has evolved over time in their latest issue.
Christian Millman is the author of The Care and Feeding of Astronauts in the December issue of Discover Magazine. He's a contributing editor there. Christian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Veronica. It's good to talk to you both again.
Well, if I may start your story in a gross moment, you kick things off with talking about a wet burp in space. Why start there?
I tamed that down quite a bit. But it was a visceral example of just some of the many challenges faced among the original astronauts heading into space. If you think about it, eating in space is not something we should be able to do, and it wasn't even known if we could eat in space. A wet burp was just one of the many things that came out of those early days of Discovery.
Right. Now, why was it not exactly a foregone conclusion whether or not astronauts could even eat stuff in space?
The impact of gravity on the ability of your system to digest and absorb food wasn't known. It wasn't known if you needed gravity to actually pull the food through your system, if you needed that gravity assist, or if it would work normally in a zero-gravity environment. Those were very fundamental questions that we couldn't have known until we started going to space.
Well, the good news is we can. The esophagus and the process of it, I always love this word, peristalsis.
Peristalsis is a beautiful thing. Think of it as a python. It's the mouse going through the snake in that sort of writhing sort of contraction. That's how we work from stem to stern, so to speak, and that's what gets food through us, and essentially, it's a fairly complex biological process, but that's what gets the nutrients into our system. Turns out, happily, we don't need gravity.
Well, and it sounds like the very first food, once they figured out, astronauts can eat in space, it was stuff that was pureed and came out of a tube, kind of like, I don't know, it sounds like toothpaste.
It was, and in fact, I'd rather eat toothpaste compared to many of the things. My dog used to have a meat-flavored toothpaste that would have been preferable to many of the things that the early space travelers faced.
Well, what did they eat?
It was pureed anything that would give them the nutrients they needed. My dog's meat toothpaste actually was probably very similar to the pureed beef that the earliest astronauts ate. It was anything you could squeeze into a tube. That was during the first episode, or the first missions, and it progressed later from there to slightly better, but still not good until we got into the 80s, really.
And we joke about, gross astronaut food, but this is serious stuff for the people who have to go up and eat this stuff first for a few days and then maybe months, and then, hey, maybe someday for a long time on the way to Mars.
It's actually very serious business, and NASA and other space agencies take it seriously. It can actually compromise missions if you can't get people to accept the food for long periods of time. And people who run prisons, just thinking back to your previous interview, they know this. Ship captains and people who run prisons know that if you don't have enough variety, food takes on an undue importance with people who are confined to small spaces, and you can actually have mission failures because of things like menu fatigue.
And there was one incident of an astronaut, I guess, being so unhappy with what was going to be on the offering up there that he snuck in a corned beef sandwich.
Well, actually, he didn't, but he was one of the most vociferous he complained most vociferously about the terrible food in the early space days. And actually, what what took place, it was in March 1965. Gus Grissom was the commander on Gemini 3, and those were two-person crews. So they blast off into space on this tiny little capsule, which is smaller than any hatchback you've ever been in. And they reach orbit, and his co-pilot reaches into his spacesuit pocket and pulls out a corned beef sandwich, which was Grissom's favorite sandwich, and says, "Hey, Skip, would you care for a sandwich?" And it turned into a beautiful moment that had some big ramifications back on Earth, because he took a few bites, and the crumbs became so problematic that they threatened to foul some of the instruments, so he put it away after a couple of bites. And as far as I can tell, it's the only time a sandwich has caused a congressional hearing. When they got back to the planet and people found out that they had smuggled the sandwich on board, one member of Congress got very sort of huffy about it and called it a congressional hearing. You have to remember, this was the hottest part of the Cold War, and anything that could be considered a threat to the space program was taken very seriously.
Talking to Christian Millman from Discover Magazine, talk about the history of astronaut food. Well, in that sandwich illustrates the engineering challenge of the food. Part of the problem was the rye bread, the crumbs flew around, they could clog equipment. This is what NASA and other space programs are contending with. That once it gets inside us, we can digest it, but until it gets inside us, it has to not get out and foul everything up.
You're absolutely correct. And you can actually have bread in space if you coat it with gel. And that's about as
yum.
Pleasant as it sounds. Yes, exactly. The six people on the International Space Station just had a turkey dinner that would not have been unfamiliar to most people, except in its experience. It sounds good, but it has to be treated in such a way that you know it's not your mom's cooking.
Well, Skylab, it sounds like the first American space station decided to try to improve on this. What was that? What's Skylab menu like?
Skylab menu was enormous, and it hasn't been replicated ever since. There were hundreds of menu items available on Skylab. They had capabilities like freezers that are no longer available just because it's too complex to maintain those systems. But one of the big missions for Skylab was to figure out how to feed people for the long term in space, and they came a long way. In fact, most of what we know and use today was learned aboard Skylab, and that was in the 1970s. So once you learn it, it's good. There's no shelf life on that particular bit of food.
So what is the state of the art now? How, if I'm an astronaut, what am I eating out of? What does it look and taste like?
Well, I'll tell you what the six people ate yesterday. They had irradiated smoked turkey, so that it would have been slices of turkey, similar to what you'd see in a deli case. They would have had thermostabilized candied yams. I don't even want to try with that one. Freeze-dried vegetables, probably green beans or mushrooms, could have been corn. They would have had a freeze-dried cornbread dressing. And you can actually make that recipe if you wanted. Just search it on NASA.gov. It makes a ton, if you want to see what it's like. And for dessert, they would have had a thermostabilized cobbler. So these are pouch foods primarily. And if you've ever seen the foods that campers take on into the backwoods or the military ready-to-eat meals, they're very similar. So most people have some context for what you eat in space now.
What is
it? It all has a very funny flavor that's just off.
What does thermostabilize mean in this context?
Thermostabilize just means that you don't have to refrigerate it. It's packaged and prepared so that it doesn't have to be kept at a certain temperature.
Now, we have an international space station. Does an American astronaut want something different than, say, a Russian astronaut?
Sure, and that happens all the time. They will, before they go into space, they'll start choosing items for their individual menus. But, you know, things change. We've lost several supply missions this year, and there was a lot of food on those supply missions, so they had to repeat things that they wouldn't necessarily have to have repeated otherwise. So you do have a lot more individual choice now, and the ability to trade between other astronauts who are, you know, the food is supplied on a country-by-country basis, so the Russians are getting very different food, and that, I'm sure, makes for some pretty good poker games in space.
Now, my kids, for whatever reasons unknown to me, they enjoy what's, you know, known as astronaut ice cream.
Is
that a real thing?
It is a real thing, and if you've been to a museum or if you've been to many camping stores, you'll see the foil packets of freeze-dried ice cream, and I loosely call it ice cream. It's truly awful stuff. The kids love it, and it has persisted as the image of astronaut food since the 70s. And it actually only made it into space once before the astronauts actually dumped it because it was too terrible.
As we wrap up, Christian, any cutting-edge things out there briefly that might be on the next wave of space missions?
The next wave is going to be all about how to get enough food into space for the longer-term missions. So if you're going to be on a Mars mission, for example, for years, how do you get that much food into space to support each astronaut? It's about 3,000 pounds right now for each astronaut to make a return trip to Mars, including time on surface. So you have to either pre-stage that food, which means have it floating in orbit somewhere around Mars or somewhere between here and Mars where you can pick it up on the way.
And we got to leave it there, Christian. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That was Christian Millman, contributing editor for Discover Magazine. He was with us to talk about his piece in the latest issue. It's called The Care and Feeding of the Astronauts.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. News is next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
For a lot of us, Thanksgiving is a day of eating good food and often a lot of it. And the day after Thanksgiving is a great time to enjoy what's left of that epic meal. And our guest says that whatever leftovers are in favor or out of fashion depends a lot on economic conditions and even moral imperatives.
Helen Veit is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. She's the author of Modern Food, Moral Food, Self-Control, Science, and the Rise of Modern American Eating in the Early 20th Century. Helen, welcome to Central Time. Helen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, but before refrigerators, leftovers weren't a thing, or they were something very different than we think of them now. What was the pre-refrigerator leftover like?
In pre-refrigerator America, which really is the 19th century, leftovers were, it's not that they didn't exist, that they were so common that people didn't feel a need to use a special name for them. Using up food left from one meal was absolutely essential to economic solvency, to survival in some cases. So leftovers were something that people dealt with all the time, usually by reincorporating them into the next meal, often eating them for breakfast, things like leftover pie or leftover meat or leftover beans, whatever you had, and sometimes by incorporating them into stews or things like that.
And you had to do it quickly.
Absolutely. Cooking really was a race against decay in the 19th century, so knowing how to use up leftovers and consuming them quickly was really key.
So with the refrigerator coming along, I understand from your piece that one of the first leftover cookbooks was actually commissioned by a refrigerator company. So they knew they had something new here.
Absolutely. What was so distinct about having refrigeration in the home? And when people talked about refrigerators in the early days, they often meant ice boxes, so not, you know, electric refrigerators. But what was new was that you could serve exactly the same food, or a dinner, for example, that was recognizably the same dinner, maybe 3 days later. That had never happened before. So people started to think of this as a new culinary category.
But our attitude toward serving that meal again and again has really changed, really oscillated back and forth over time. And I want to start with that idea in the Great Depression, where leftovers were a virtue, maybe even a necessity.
For some Americans, they were absolutely a necessity. But the 1930s also marked the start of what I think of as this sort of golden age of leftovers, where people really celebrated the cook's ingenuity in repackaging leftovers, maybe fooling reluctant family members into eating them, applying art to making them newly exciting, you know, maybe putting them in a Jell-O mold, for example, or using a sort of special gourmet casserole to you know, put them into, use that as a vehicle. And so the 1930s, really through the 1950s, were in some ways the high point of leftovers, in part because of economics. People wanted to use this food up as, you know, part of their family budgeting. But also as this sort of new venue for creativity and sort of culinary creativity.
Now, that Depression era came out of the 20s, a time of prosperity, but then before that, World War One. We'd already seen some back and forth on leftovers. World War One, I guess people were wanting to save food to help starving kids in Belgium.
Absolutely. There was actually a huge home front conservation campaign in America during World War One, mainly to send food to places like Belgium that had been invaded and that needed food, also eventually to send food to U.S. soldiers. So on the home front, the U.S. government launched an enormous propaganda campaign to convince Americans not to waste food and especially to eat their leftovers. So they really focused on getting Americans to use up every crumb, to cook things like casseroles and stews, things that weren't actually that fashionable at the time. Even pasta dishes. Pasta got a real boost in the war because of this emphasis on leftovers. Some people even did things like suggesting that cafeterias or restaurants scrape dirty plates and try to resell that food. Some people in this era even said that cooks at home should strain their dishwater and all of the food, the little food fragments that were left, they should put those into a soup. So they really took it to an extreme in some cases.
And did we see in that World War One time and then up in the Great Depression, cookbooks, newspaper articles, things like that, helping us use those leftovers, maybe not to the extreme of those that dishwater, but casseroles and things like that?
Absolutely. What was so interesting was that by the 1910s and later, people were really talking about leftovers as their own distinct genre, their own category. And so, yes, cookbooks started to talk about them specifically. Newspaper articles definitely did, too.
Talking to Helen Veit from Michigan State University. She's a historian, and we're looking at the history of leftovers. Okay, you said 30s through World War II, Depression through World War II, leftovers of virtue, maybe into the 50s. What starts to change then?
Well, one thing that was changing was that Americans as a whole were spending less of their budgets on food. You can really see the U.S. Department of Agriculture has charted this, and you can just see the numbers plummet in terms of the percentage of their incomes that Americans were spending on food. Food was more abundant than it had ever been, and it was cheaper. And so that urgency, that sense that this was something that had to be done, we had to use up food, really faded for a lot of people. Even some relatively working class or poor Americans, leftovers became less urgent, and plate waste became much more common. And so leftovers went from something that was, sort of applying creativity to a task that had to be done, and increasingly by the 1960s, into something that seemed kind of like a drag. In many, many households, people continued to eat leftovers. Thrift was still a virtue, but leftovers themselves lost really any sense of glamour or excitement, and they became a very second-rate kind of meal. One you might sort of slog through on a weekday with a few eye rollings, but definitely not one that you would serve to company or one that you would necessarily brag about in a special cookbook.
And speaking of cookbooks, you trace this change through different editions of The Joy of Cooking cookbook. What happened with leftovers over time there?
That's right. That was one of my favorite parts of researching this article was getting to really comb through these different Joy of Cooking editions. In the beginning, the author, Irma Rambauer, was incredibly pro-leftover. She had a long section on leftovers. She carefully inventoried every recipe in the book that could serve as a vehicle for leftovers. She detailed her favorite techniques. That stayed in the Joy of Cooking editions for the next couple of decades. But by the early 1960s, the leftovers section became drastically condensed. It started with a joke about how leftovers were sort of dreary and no one wanted to eat them. The authors by that point, which included her daughter, started urging people not to disdain leftovers, saying, you don't have to think of them as this awful thing. They can be okay. That was a real shift in tone that really ushered in this new era of, to some degree, not even talking much about leftovers in cookbooks at all. By the end of the 20th century, The Joy of Cooking barely mentions leftovers, because it's just sort of assumed, you can maybe reheat it in the microwave, but it's not something we're going to go to the trouble of printing a special recipe about.
So we're less interested in eating our leftovers. Do we start to waste more food around this time?
Absolutely. American food waste has shot up over the course of the 20th century, in part because things that used to exist to take care of food waste, like compost and also pigs, have disappeared for a lot of people. Pigs, in particular, used to be a great way to transmogrify leftovers into bacon. You know, you could take your spoiled milk or your scraps from the table, feed them to your pig, and then, you know, eventually you could butcher the pig and you would have a lot of meat as a result. Even, and I think that surprises a lot of Americans, but that wasn't just farm families. Even in towns and sometimes even in cities in the early 20th century, a lot of people kept pigs. Of course, that's pretty rare these days.
Yeah, urban chickens are in, but I don't think municipal
right.
codes are recognizing
they're
the pigs
so,
in such a friendly way. But there is, pigs aside, there has been a resurgence, you write, in leftovers. So what happened? Why did we start to love the leftover again?
Well, I think there's really a lot of new awareness about the ecological dimensions of food waste, that food, even if it doesn't seem like it costs that much when it comes to the budget. We're actually still spending a really low amount of our budget on food. It's very costly in other ways. People are newly aware about the tolls that transporting food or irrigating food crops or the petroleum used to harvest food or to cook it at home. All of these have gotten new attention as subjects of ecological concern, things we need to think about and reduce if possible. So the same people who are, you know, more conscious about their environmental impact are trying to reduce their food waste. At the same time, there's also been a real explosion, I think, in the foodie side of leftovers. The fact that if you make a stew or a curry or a lasagna and you let it sit for a few days, it can actually taste better. The flavors can meld. There's new appreciation, I think, of that this is not something with stigma, that, in fact, this can be a way to elevate taste.
Now, I don't know if I'm an outlier. I cook with the intention of having leftovers to put either at the kids' lunches, my lunch the next day, or to have a quick dinner when we're in a rush tomorrow or the next night. Is this something that people are getting back to doing?
I think there's, you know, a lot of home cooks have always done that, you know, that's always been a sort of time-saving thing. It is interesting, though, because in some ways, you know, what is a leftover? That's actually a question that came up a surprising amount when I was researching. Do you count something that you make in advance and plan to serve later? Is that a true leftover or not? For example, is cheese a leftover? Some of these older cookbooks would say, you know, what to do with your leftover cheese? And to me, cheese isn't a leftover. It's just cheese, you know? And so that the idea of pre-cooking food to serve later, for me, brought up that issue about, you know, what we consider a leftover at all. But I totally agree with you. I'm of the school of, you know, cook when I can and eat it later when it's convenient, too.
I get to look at a fair amount of cookbooks, but I don't know that I've noticed any trend back toward talking about leftovers. Have you seen anything like that in modern-day cookbooks?
I don't see it in the same way I saw it 100 years ago. People will occasionally mention, that a certain recipe, for example, a roast pork or chicken, you know, you could reincorporate this meat in another dish. Here's an example. There are some cookbooks dedicated to leftovers now, but I think in part that's because there are just so many cookbooks now. The cookbook market is, you know, incredibly huge. So there's all sorts of, you know, there's cookbooks on every topic. I don't think as a subject it's received the same attention as it used to.
Helen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
That was Helen Veit. She's an associate professor of history at Michigan State University and the author of the book Modern Food, Moral Food, Self-Control, Science, and the Rise of Modern American Eating in the Early 20th Century.
We just heard about the history of leftovers and what they've meant in our culture over the past century. And we want to hear from you on this, the sort of high holiday of leftovers. Do you love them or do you hate them? Are you like Rob and you plan for extra leftovers? You supersize your recipes to have leftovers? Or do they just happen? And what are your favorite ways to transform leftover ingredients like, oh, say, turkey, maybe rice, potatoes, chicken? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And I know some people reject leftovers. Do you avoid eating leftovers at all costs? Is it a bummer when you eat them? Pro or con on leftovers? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Take your calls in just a minute after looking at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We just heard about the history of leftovers and how they've changed over the years as economic conditions have also changed.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you rely on leftovers to get a quick meal on the table when you're growing up? Were leftovers celebrated or shunned? What's your favorite leftover ingredient to use? Share a memory, a thought, a recipe at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or head over to the Central Time Facebook page, share your thoughts, find some convenient leftover turkey recipes. We'll go to our callers now. Sharon is on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Sharon, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to tell you that we were at a friend's house one evening and they grilled steaks. And they either grilled too many or some people didn't show up. And the hostess was going to throw them away at the end of the night. And I said, well, I hope this doesn't sound too tacky, but if you're going to throw them away, I'll take them home.
And what'd you do with them, Sharon?
I made omelets for breakfast the next morning.
Oh, sure, steak and eggs. And you know, steak and eggs, Sharon, is that something I would take a raw steak and cook it in the morning and make with eggs? You got that steak cooked. That's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
Sharon, thank you so much for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. Yeah, I don't know about, I mean, I'm pretty big on leftovers, but I think that's pretty extreme. Like, we got these leftover steaks. Toss them.
I don't know, does steaks get leathery in the morning? I don't eat a whole lot of red meat. Is that something you gotta worry about?
Leftover beef, I think, on a sandwich or a steak and eggs like she did, that's fine. Yeah, I mean, it's not as fresh and tender as your steak aficionados would want, but also it's... It's not cheap. I wouldn't want to just drop it in the garbage.
Yeah.
Feed it to a dog,
right,
at least.
The whole leftover food issue.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Sharon. Let's go on to Rob in Milwaukee. Rob, hi.
Hello.
Hi. Growing what do you like?
Growing up, we used leftovers all the time, but now I take, when I make a roast, I put it in the crock pot, the leftovers, and make a vegetable beef soup out of it, or like turkey. I'll be eating sandwiches, and then the leftovers from that, I take to work, or like dinner, I take to work, and at work, everybody at lunchtime's like, what are you eating today?
And you'll say it was last night's fill in the blank here. Well, that's great, Rob. Thank you for that call. And I know a lot of people do look forward to leftover turkey and experiment with it. I talked to a friend who said he was really looking forward to turkey wild rice soup the next day. So
that
sometimes there are these traditions surrounding the leftovers, too.
Thanks a lot for that, Rob. We are talking leftovers, and we want to find out if you love them, if you hate seeing those leftovers show up on the table a second, third, fourth time, what your favorite leftovers are, what you do with them. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We go next to Spencer on the line in Eau Claire. Spencer, hi.
Hi. I take the leftover turkeys and slice them up into little pieces, put it on wax paper, and melt some cheese over it, put it on a sandwich with toast and hot sauce, butter. I just think it's the best.
So wait, we got turkey, the melted cheese, hot sauce, and butter.
Yeah, it's a little technique I noticed that they use in at like Subway restaurants and stuff like that with the wax paper and the microwave. Yep.
Interesting. And any particular kind of bread or bun you like to serve that on, Spencer?
Something kind of a healthy seeming, like a honey wheat whole grain toast.
Sounds yeah. And have you done that with Thanksgiving leftovers so already this year, Spencer?
Yes, I have. It's been real good. I prefer it probably to the Thanksgiving meal.
All right. Better than the original. Spencer, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234.
And Deb on Facebook writes, Thanksgiving leftovers are the best. My favorite is bubble and squeak, patties of mashed potatoes, turkey, and stuffing fried in butter.
It's fantastic to mix those things up.
Yeah.
I told you I didn't do a traditional Thanksgiving this year. I made turkey tacos. I had some other things. Loved how it came out. My one regret is that I don't get to mix up the turkey, the mashed potatoes, and the stuffing the next day.
Mashed
that is
potatoes,
my one regret.
Yeah, you could try mashed potatoes. Make fresh mashed potatoes.
True.
And stuff your turkey tacos in them. My theory, and I'm going to go out on the limb here, is
wow.
that mashed potatoes are the tabula rasa of food, and that
you can
put anything in them, and they will taste fine.
Like anything savory.
Anything? Well, I don't know. I haven't tried
stuff leftover pumpkin pie and mashed potatoes.
I'm going to say it might be tasty.
Don't try this at home, kids. We'll go back to the callers now. Kevin is on the line in Tomahawk. Kevin, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My wife makes pepper steak, and it's always good the first day, but it's out of this world the second day. It magnifies the flavor and everything, and it's just so much better the second day. I'm not exactly sure why.
Is there a secret to reheating it, Kevin?
No, she just puts it in a kettle on the stove and warms it up, not in the microwave, of course, but and puts it over rice. But it's like it magnifies all the flavor sitting overnight in the refrigerator, I'm assuming.
Interesting, Kevin. Thanks a lot for sharing that. I always hear, and think of things like lasagna and some soups and stews that get better as they sit in the fridge. Do you like that, too?
Yeah, so certain flavors, I think, just get deeper and richer the longer they sit. Not all things. Some things get desiccated
well, yeah.
and more difficult to eat. But some things, yeah, the lasagna is a great example of that. Well, we appreciate that call. We're going to go next to Linda in Red Granite. Linda, hi.
Hi. We have this tradition, mostly on Thanksgiving for probably 10 years now, where we make turkey pot pies out of the leftovers on Thanksgiving, and everybody takes home 2 to 3 pies.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. Is that a lot of work, or do you use pre-prepared pie crust and all of that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's pre-prepared pie crust, but then we just make a big pot of gravy and throw everything in it, the green bean casserole, the dressing, you name it, and everybody absolutely loves it. It's more family time together. We actually get an assembly line going.
Wow, I love that idea, and I bet guests love getting to go home with this special meal that reminds them of this happy time.
Yeah, not only that, you don't have a gazillion Tupperware sitting in your refrigerator.
That's right, and that's actually key,
yeah.
isn't it? Well, that's very clever. I might have to steal that some year.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And we got to check how long the drive is to Red Granite. I'm going to be hungry when I leave. I'm sure Linda's got some of that left.
She's already sent them out. There's no more on
site. Well, she must have kept some.
Oh, yeah. Maybe.
August is with us next in Baraboo. August, hi.
Hi. I grew up in a family with 9 kids, so my mom always taught us to do a lot with leftovers. But my favorite is any meat or vegetables, making a quiche.
Oh yeah.
And if you don't want to make a crust, you can get a quiche pan. Wait, there's no crust needed. And for dinner, it's great.
Do you have a favorite leftover combos in a quiche, August?
Vegetables that are kind of dry and you don't want to reheat them, because they're too dry after being in the oven or something, are great in quiche because quiche can be really wet anyway. So vegetables that are dry or even turkey that gets, the white meat sometimes can get kind of dry after being in the fridge for a while or whatever. Those dry meats are great in quiches because it keeps it from getting too wet and the flavor is amazing. It just absorbs all the moisture from the eggs and the milk.
Brilliant idea, August. Thanks so much for that. Yeah, I love having oven-roasted vegetables. There's not enough for a serving on their own, but then they can go into a soup or a stew. I hadn't thought. I mean, Keisha, that seems like an obvious one now that he says that. Of course, I didn't think of it myself.
We credit you with that, August. That's a good one. We're going to go next to Joan in West Allis. Joan, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks a lot for talking about leftovers. Such a good topic. And I was just wanting to ask you about, you think there's much of a comeback of the way that people used to deal with leftovers a lot would be with chicken soup or chicken broth, if they would have around the chicken broth. And then you just can make soup at any time. And that was a good vehicle for the leftovers of any kind.
Right. Soup. Soup's a great one. You can put a lot of stuff in soup, including, by the way, mashed potatoes.
Sure. Yeah. And I've done this. I'll take leftover chicken, whatever, and make stock with it. Story. I just read that Michael Dukakis, former Massachusetts governor, a presidential candidate in 1988, has all of his neighbors bring over their leftover turkey carcasses in Thanksgiving and make soup stock soup for his family for like the year.
Wow.
With all these
so
things.
That's what you do when you don't win the presidency.
Yeah,
you,
you
make
collect
a lot
turkey
of stock.
Carcasses and make stock. Well, thank you so much for your calls. Keep things going over at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.